Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. This is your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. Tonight's episode, episode 7, we explore memorial landscapes in an episode we call Unwanted Heritage. Stay tuned. In episode 4, Little Stories, we talked about mapping the stories of a place. No doubt looking around a city or a town, we encounter stories we can identify with, narratives we enter into, those little histories and become part of that place. Monuments, memorials, place names all shape the way in which we experience place. They frame that narrative and both enrichen and impose limitations on our encounter in that space. According to scholar Emilia Polonin and others, the city can be read as a text. Naming and memorial practices contribute to that text. Key figures in the trajectory of the city or institution are representative members of the canon of heroes. They can create ideological histories that are spread through these seemingly innocent everyday political symbols. But this commemoration oftentimes reflects only segments of a society, and alienates smaller minority groups in that same society. The process of inscribing their names or putting their statue on a pedestal, of writing this city text, is always about exclusion and inclusion. Who or what, from the vast pool of cultural, historical, and political figures, is in the end commemorated? By choosing who is legible, who we are able to read on that cityscape, we decide which past we want to celebrate and which past is obscured. Much has been commented on in cultural and historical geography regarding the politics of memory and the ways in which these politics play out on the landscape. The process of memorialization is sometimes lengthy, with much bureaucratic red tape to cut through. Controversial monuments or historic sites get much attention in the media and give reason to bring together collective voices to vote or take a referendum. Getting rid of these everyday political symbols is not easy. In tonight's episode, we explore this idea of unwanted heritage and visit three field sites. First, in Budapest, Hungary, we'll take a tour of Memento Park, a statue park built in the outskirts of the Magyar capital to house the unwanted communist-era propaganda statues. Our second site is in Braunau am Inn, a town of 20,000-plus inhabitants in Upper Austria. No matter what else I say about this town, most, if not all, the people living in the region know it as Hitler's birthplace. Yes, if you forgot, Adolf Hitler was born in Austria. There I speak with Florian Kontenko, a local historian, very much interested in dealing with the town's contemporary history. And our last site, out of Europe and into the American South, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to be exact, where the nation's first public university is struggling to deal with its own city text, with prominent buildings on campus, specifically Saunders Hall, ironically the home to the geography department, and its commemoration of Colonel William Saunders, regardless of his widely accepted connections to the Ku Klux Klan. I bring these three sites together to showcase three case studies of communities dealing with unwanted heritage, and we'll try to highlight and locate where each finds themselves in this process of remembering, forgetting, and remembering. After all, don't these subtle and sometimes not so subtle namings and memorials, when pieced together, form a narrative about who we are, about who we were? Don't they help shape who we will become? These memorial landscapes say just as much about who we were as they signal who we are becoming. These memorial landscapes inform geographical imaginations because they link the landscape to our collective, but mostly selective, memories. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out on the internet at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to the episode, Unwanted Heritage. Following the democratic change post-Soviet occupation, Hungarians were divided about what to do with their cityscape and the number of Soviet propaganda statues placed all around Budapest. Many wanted to destroy or melt down the monuments, but there were enough people who wanted to preserve them and use them to mark democratic change. Finally, the Budapest City Council supported the idea, and Memento Park, after years of planning, opened in 1993. Here is Dora Szkolkik from Memento Park.
The concept here, it's like not merely about communism, about the fall of communism. And these statues had been removed from Budapest streets and squares following the democratic change. And the collection here represents the moment of the democratic change. The message of it is like, firstly, it's about our history. It's not piping the past regime. Right. Everyone can decide what's his or her opinion about communism in general, about the Hungarian things with the new generation. It's an educational site.
Right.
Finally.
And how many monuments are here at the park?
There are 42 statues with the Stalin grandstand, uh-huh. but this one is just a replica.
Right. Okay. So those are the boots, Stalin's boots.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So it's like in Budapest, were installed once about 100 propaganda monuments,
uh-huh.
and these were the most emblematic statues. Really,
yeah. We're standing out here. It's actually pretty cold today.
Yes.
And a gray day, which I have to comment on. Just coming and seeing communist era statues. Coming myself from New York area in the United States, the propaganda maybe we saw was that, you know, the communist world, it was always cloudy. And so this is kind of...
Exactly. It's a great
It's a great day to be here, I think.
This is my first trip behind the invisible Iron Curtain. I spent days walking around Budapest looking at street names, monuments, and memorials, getting a sense of the city by reading it. This reading gives us a narrative to follow, a mythology of the capital of Hungary. There, at Memento Park, were statues of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, the anonymous worker, the hopeful youth. What story did these monuments want to tell?
I mean, they tried to show up that Hungary was liberated by the Red Army, and always you could see an inscription on the pedestal of the monuments which glorified the liberators, okay, the so-called liberators.
As Hungary was liberated by the occupation forces, a friendship was formed, and this bond was cast in iron and displayed throughout the city. sometimes with a similar message.
In the center, you can see the inscription, but exactly the same inscription was once in the center of it.
And what did it say? Just
it's about
we are the liberators, or
it's about the liberation, and then we have to be grateful for the Soviet soldiers. And there are a few words about the eternal friendship and so on, sometimes as well in the other inscriptions too.
Yeah. And that friendship, the friendship between the Hungarian and the Russian, or the Soviet, I should say, is depicted in some of the statues here. And there's interesting point about the height of both, or the size of both persons. And you mentioned on one that one's lending both hands in a handshake, whereas the Soviet's lending only one. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah. It's like that's on your own monument to the Soviet-Hungarian friendship. It stood once on the on Gellért Hill. And the body position of the two figures are really telling. As you mentioned, the Soviet soldier was represented bigger, and actually, like you see that where is the authority? I mean, like who is the boss? Something like this. And
right.
On the other side, there is the poor Hungarian one. Actually, you know, it's not by mistake either. So there were extra messages, in the monuments.
Right, a subtext.
And,
yeah.
Of course. And actually, you couldn't do anything if you was on a sculpture. The work of them was always controlled.
Budapest decided, in agreement with the Soviets or Russians, to keep one memorial where it had originally been placed, on what is translated as Liberty Square, next to the Parliament building that can be seen along the Danube.
Yeah, so these had been removed, and there is just one Soviet heroic memorial, the last one. It can be found in the Sabotchak there, Liberty Square, not far from the Parliament, in the center of the square. There is the memorial, and it's there because there was an agreement between Russia and Hungary.
It's still there today.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. By the way, let me tell you that it was one of the first Soviet heroic memorials installed in Budapest. It's from 1945.
Oh wow!
In 45, we had.
Not all monuments were wiped from the cityscape. But not all were kept intact either. Memento Park highlights Stalin's boots. Completed in 1951 as a gift to Joseph Stalin from the Hungarian people for his 70th birthday, it was torn down in October 1956 and has become a monument, recontextualized, to the 1956 revolution. A life-size copy is on view at Memento Park, but the story behind the boots is quite interesting.
You had mentioned, so these are the boots here, Stalin's boots are a replica. And you had mentioned that there's other parts of that statue in museums in Budapest, is that correct?
No, not just in Budapest, but there is a town called Debrecen. The museum is like the Modem. And there can be found one of his eyes and one of his ears. And
from that same statue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the original pieces. The hand, one of his hands can be found in the National Museum. Okay, but that's all. No idea about the boots and so on. Sometimes I see guys on the internet, the Hungarian version of the eBay, try to sell a piece of it, but I'm not sure that's from this one.
All right.
No idea.
Do they sell?
Yes.
Are people bidding on them? Yeah.
Actually, not really. I have seen once, but I don't have any idea that how they found it. I mean,
right.
Could they sell or not really?
Right.
Behind this Iron Curtain, other countries have taken the propaganda monuments down and attempted to recontextualize them in different ways.
You said there's other statue parks, that there might be one, that there's one in Bulgaria and Lithuania, was
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, in Lithuania it's called the Grutas Park.
Uh-huh.
There are about 60 propaganda monuments,
yeah.
but it's a pretty different concept. It's more like an adventure park,
yeah.
something like this.
Uh-huh.
But worth to check it out for sure. That's a private museum as well.
Yeah.
And the other one was opened a few years ago in 2011 in Sofia. There is a great poster exhibition as well,
uh-huh.
but there are no more similar collections.
Right.
Okay, so just these three
yeah.
Museums, but of course there are many different institutions, museums on communism, but not with propaganda monuments.
Yeah,
no.
Right.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme or perhaps a question and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check us out at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to the episode. I'm here in Bernau, at the birthplace of Adolf Hitler, and I'm meeting with Mr. Florian Kotenko, who's the head of the Society for Contemporary History. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming to Braunau.
So I wanted to ask you about the Hitler House, I guess we can call it, the place where Adolf Hitler's family lived when he was born. And it's one of, it's a site here in your town. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the home?
Well, the house was built in the middle of the 18th century. It was an inn. It was used as an inn in the ground floor, and in the upper floor, two upper floors, there were some families living on flats for rent. It was a brewery, and it's located in the, now it's called Salzburger Vorstadt. Number 15, but when Hitler was born, it was called Vorstadt 219. It was privately owned and is still in private ownership by the Pommer family, who bought the house in 1912. When Hitler was born there, some other families were living in the same house. We do not know the exact place where the family lived. Even the floor is in discussion.
And there's a kind of an interesting thing here is that this wasn't his home for, let's say, through elementary school. I mean, the town actually wasn't. You mentioned that he left here, his family left when he was 3 years old. But how much time did they actually spend in this home?
We do not know the exact time, but as far as we know, the family lived there for some weeks, because short after his mother gave birth to Adolf, the family transferred to the Linzer Straße, which is another main street in Braunau.
And that home isn't necessarily marked, and people don't talk about that as the Hitler home, do they?
No, it's not marked as the family's residence for 2.5 years. But on the opposite side of the Linzer Straße, there is a so-called Stolperstein, which remembers the people killed during Nazi time. And this is rather ironical, but so you can find the house.
Yeah, and speaking of sort of markers, there's outside the Hitler home is, can you tell us a little bit of the history of marking this as a historical site, so to speak, because it kind of has an interesting history there.
Well, the house was unmarked up to 1989. It was the 100th birthday, and the public authorities of Braunau were frightened by expecting or by thinking about neo-Nazi demonstrations in Braunau, and so they wanted to mark the house as contradicting the pro-Nazi positions. They wanted to fix a plaque on the facade of the house, but as it's privately owned, without the consent of the owner, it was forbidden by court. And so they put the mayor, the then mayor, Mr. Skiba, in 1989, had a stone from the concentration camp of Mauthausen in Upper Austria put in front of the house on public ground, where the inscription says, no war again, no fascism, millions of dead people are warning. And the position of this stone is not mentioned. The stone doesn't mention the name Hitler, but in the written tourist guide, it's mentioned as the stone in front of Hitler's birthhouse. And there are signposts in Braunau with some information, but not on a place, a good place.
Right. And so how recent are those, sort of the development of that tourist guide and then the public history kiosk that we saw? How new are those?
Well, the public kiosk is rather very new. It's dating back from 2012. The written tourist guide, I think, is about 5 years old. So it's rather recent times it's showed publicly.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit earlier about the town, the local museum, and its history. Does it focus on contemporary history at all? And does Hitler even enter into what they do there, what they're curating?
No, the local museum, it's a pity. It shows the golden era of Braunau during the 15th and 16th centuries, but it does not refer to any contemporary history. So, but it's, I have to state that it's under reconstruction. It's open to the public, but there will be a new focus on the 20th century.
In terms of the house and what it was being used, just to give the listeners a little bit of background, you know, Austria, historical background or a reminder, I guess, is that Austria was occupied by Nazi Germany. And so this town, did Hitler come back through this town when he was Führer? Did he recognize this town? And what other things have happened during the war and post-war to the home?
Up to 1938, the home was used as an inn. On the 12th of March, when 1938, when German troops invaded Austria, Hitler came to his birth town. He entered it crossing the Inn River Bridge and passed the main square of the town, which was renamed to Adolf Hitler Platz. He traveled by car, passing his birth house, and then the cavalcade turned, passed again, and left Braunau. He didn't stop in Braunau, he didn't enter his birth house, and he didn't come back to Braunau again. The house was bought by Martin Bormann on behalf of the Nazi Party, who was Secretary General of the Nazi Party. And in 1943, it was opened to the public as a public library and art gallery. There were exhibitions of local and regional painters and artists. After the war, as nobody knew exact what had happened to Martin Bormann, if there were any heirs to be respected, but as he was a German citizen, it came under the Austrian government's authority. And in the early 1950s, it was given back to the Palmer family, who had owned it up to from 1912 to 1938. And then it was used as a home for school classes, as a home for a bank, as but it was never only once used as a museum. It was used for an exhibition in November 1945, to show the people of Braunau the cruelties and atrocities which had happened during Nazi times in concentration camps, for instance. And then, since the 1970s, there was the so-called Lebenshilfe, an organization working and assisting mentally handicapped people based in this house. And as they wanted to modernize the building and the housing and the offices, they asked the owner, but she refused to accept any rebuilding of the house. And so they left the house. And since the autumn of 2011, the house is empty. It's still in private ownership, but the Austrian Ministry of the Interior pays the rent, about 5,000 euros a month. And as it's criticized for doing this for an empty house, they are trying to find some options to deal with the problem. They have lawyers examining the possibility of expropriation. They are trying to buy it. And they are trying to the contract to finish the contract, which is the basis for the renting. But there is no decision made up until now.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out at www.geographicalimaginations.org. If you have any comments or ideas for future episodes, please go to the comments section and send us a note. Look forward to your feedback. Now, let's get back to our episode. In terms of the town as a whole, what's the reception of the town and or by the town of this house, and how people view it? I can imagine that's changed over time. Has there ever been a time where people said, "Let's get rid of it"?
Well, the first who wanted to get rid of it were the Germans. In May 1945, when the American troops already had liberated Braunau, a German commando tried to enter the town and to blow up the house. But they were rejected by American troops, and so the house still is in existence. A Russian parliamentarian wanted to buy it, to blow it up. But this didn't work, and it wouldn't solve the problem, in my opinion, because the history connects Braunau and Hitler, and it's not the house, but it's the connection of Braunau and Hitler. The house is just an empty building.
Yeah, and with your Society for Contemporary History, it sounds like part of what you've been doing is education. You know, meeting with me in our conversation, you've mentioned a number of other journalists that you've met with, and really kind of showing showing your town in some ways. The Society, though, started, I believe it was in 1992. You had a symposium or you had a conference that was about unwanted heritage. Can you tell us how that started and then what that conversation has really developed in over the past, you know, 20, 25 years?
The conversation started by inviting representatives from communities with similar problems. We had guests from Nuremberg, from Bautzen, from Osijenzim, from Vichy, who all had an unwanted heritage in terms of historical connotation. The use of the house, as a matter of fact, by the Lebenshilfe, by housing mentally handicapped people, was accepted by all of them as a very good way of dealing with the past, because people who were supposed to be killed during Nazi time now live in the home where Hitler was born. When the Lebenshilfe went out, the situation had changed. And now the discussion had started from the very beginning, because the Austrian Republic, who is not that rich country, spends a lot of money for an empty house. And on the other hand, the owner doesn't accept any changing or modernizing of the building. For Braunau, it's not our responsibility that Hitler was born here, but we are responsible for dealing with the fact of this unwanted heritage. Braunau never was a brown Nazi country. During elections in the interwar time, the Nazi Party got a maximum of about 7.5% of all the voters in Braunau. And in other towns in Austria, there was the percentage much higher than. At the referendum about the Anschluss in 1938, there were 5 votes against the Anschluss, and most of them in the polling station at Hitler's birth house.
It was the polling station to decide.
Yeah, it was the polling station to decide whether you were pro or contra Anschluss. And the most of the contra, the no voters, were in the birth house of Hitler.
So the house has definitely had this interesting, it has its own interesting history, besides just having Hitler been born there or been spent the first 3 or 4 weeks of his life living there with his parents. If there was one thing you would say, having spoken with other communities about unwanted heritage and having opened up that dialogue here through your society and bringing together people from different communities who are dealing with those and grappling with those same kind of historical legacies or historical baggage, you might say. What would you, having gone through this experience, what would you recommend to a community that's looking to do that? And how do you start? How do you deal with that unwanted past, that unwanted heritage?
First of all, I would say, in our experience, a free, frank discussion is necessary. Secrecy doesn't bring any positive elements into the discussion. I would like to have a documentation in front of the house showing what was, what had happened there. And it's not the house was not the place for decisions on Holocaust. It was not the place for decisions on war crimes. it was not a house where atrocities took place, but it was the birth house of a baby who turned into one of the most cruel dictators in the history of mankind. And you have to see what had happened here, and you have to see what had happened elsewhere. Hitler didn't learn anti-Semitism in Braunau. He didn't learn racism in Braunau. There were other influences on his youth who turned out as consequences in his political, let's say, career. The fact he is born here can't be annihilated.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing your comments with us. We really appreciate it here at Geographical Imaginations. Thanks.
Thank you so much, and have a nice time.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out on the internet at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to the episode, Unwanted Heritage. For our third site, I travel virtually to North Carolina in the United States by watching the current debate through social media, YouTube videos officially posted by the university, short films by the Real Silent Sam Coalition and by Rename Saunders. I will post links on my website. The debate is this in Chapel Hill: what to do with a building named in 1923 to commemorate a man who lived between 1822 and 1900, who, while making serious contributions as a compiler of North Carolina history — Saunders Hall was the old history building — but at the same time was the chief organizer of the Ku Klux Klan, or KKK, the right-wing extremist group who emphasized white supremacy, initially in the American South in the post-Civil War Reconstruction era. While it has become generally accepted that Saunders was in fact a leader of this secret and violent society, the question for all watching remains: why does a world-class institution whose reach is most definitely global and whose ranking in the world of academics and research continues to rise well into the top 100 internationally, why has it waited so many years to address this highly racialized, highly violent, and highly political naming of a building? What are they doing about this unwanted heritage? Will they reframe it if they do, this at once seemingly provincial history, as part of a global history of injustice and subjugation?
This UNC academic building
takes its name from Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon William L. Saunders.
The Klan stands for racism, hatred, and terror.
Does our university stand for racism?
For hatred? For terror?
Each time we cross the threshold into this building,
we are reminded that for 93 years,
UNC has commemorated a white supremacist who demeaned,
dishonored, and cut short the lives
of others in North Carolina.
As UNC geography students,
we call on the legacies of oppression encoded in the naming of this building and others on this campus to be remembered.
We join students and professors who, for decades,
have asked that Saunders Hall be renamed.
We are no longer asking.
We demand an end to the commemoration of this legacy
of prejudice and violence.
UNC,
this is a moment for which you will be judged.
To be a leading American university and global institution,
acknowledge the histories of your racist past.
Do what is right.
What is nonviolent.
What should have been done long ago.
Rename Saunders.
Rename Saunders Hall.
Rename Saunders Hall.
Black lives mattered then,
and they matter now.
So we were just listening to Rename Saunders via YouTube video. These are graduate students from the Geography Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They really contextualize, I think, the debate, and especially the spirit of the debate, in the context of world and global justice. So let's go to the policy. I think it's really interesting to look at how complicated some of these policies are. And they're in place supposedly for good reason. I imagine they're in place to not allow for a complete sort of tide change in how naming practices work on a campus or for an institution. So institutionalized practices in a lot of ways move slowly. And so change in this case would move slowly. It's an 8-page document about naming of buildings on the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill campus. And I'm looking at on page 7, if you have it, and I'll put a link on the website, revocation of naming approval or conferral. So in certain circumstances, the university reserves the right on reasonable grounds to revoke and terminate its obligations regarding a naming, with no financial responsibility for returning any received contributions to the benefactor. So that's in the case of if you're giving money and get a building named after you. But it's the second part that I think is the most interesting here. If the benefactor's or honoree's reputation changes substantially so that the continued use of that name may compromise the public trust, dishonor the university's standards, or otherwise be contrary to the best interests of the university, the naming may be revoked. However, caution must be taken when, with the passage of time, the standards and achievements deemed to justify a naming action may change, and observers of a later age may deem those who conferred a naming honor at an earlier age to have erred. So namings should not be altered simply because later observers would have made different judgments. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out on the internet at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to the episode, Unwanted Heritage. After over 15 years of a visual on-campus campaign to raise awareness about Saunders Hall and other negatives of this institutional history, including a large statue of Confederate soldier Silent Sam, the Real Silent Sam Coalition has finally gotten its day. The Board of Trustees agreed to have an open forum to discuss the future of Saunders Hall. During the open forum of March 2015, sponsored by those Board of Trustees, many members of the campus community were granted about 6 to 8 minutes to voice their ideas for how to move forward and what to do with Saunders. I watched this video on YouTube, almost 2 hours long, quite an interesting debate, quite an interesting exploration of what it is to memorialize, what it is to remember, and how the campus of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the University of North Carolina, is dealing with its racial history. During the open forum, the opinions were quite diverse, but there seemed to be a consensus at the very least, which I think is perhaps a huge milestone in this process, is to come to agreement about who Saunders was. From the Real Silent Sam Coalition to the College Republicans, everyone agreed that he was a perpetrator of violence. Even the Republicans called him part of a terrorist insurgency, which may be part of our post-9/11 lexicon, but at the same time, a recognition of this violent past. There were scholars who have spent much time talking about public memory, who offered up some of their own ideas, including kicking out the Geography Department and Religious Studies Department, and opening up in this very same Saunders building to open up a museum or a public history exhibit that talks about the racial history on University of North Carolina's campus. Others talked about the naming practice. Should we take off the name is one of the big questions. And the Silent Sam, Real Silent Sam Coalition suggests renaming the building after one of the first African-American graduates, a woman, the writer Zora Neale Hurston, and call it Hurston Hall. Others cautioned against taking off the name, not that they were saying to take the name off completely, but others are cautioning about renaming, because in some ways that might erase all that's been fought for here. And in fact, leaving that racialized history, leaving that even violent history on the landscape, but recodified, is perhaps the solution, or perhaps a way to move forward. And it's that recodification, like we saw in Budapest, that I think we might bring together. All in all, people were talking about how the past must be made accountable. But we must open up our discussion of these histories. Look at what people are on that landscape and what people are left off. If we can acknowledge the ugliness, it was said, and not take it so personally, perhaps we can move forward. These are all small quotes from that, from this, I think, really important meeting of moving forward. All the groups recognized that William Saunders, in his context, historical context, that his ideas set back racial progress for decades as part of the Reconstruction South, as a leader of the KKK who did not want to see equal rights achieved. And so all in all, the campus, I think, as a community, is perhaps seeing this as a chance for education. An education of its new undergraduate students, education of its new professors coming in, education for itself to delve into its own history and understand itself as an institution and move forward. This is not meant to single out the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, because they are by no means the only university or institution, for that matter, with racial and cultural history that's left untold in all of its complexity. Other colleges and universities, just as much in the North as in the South, are dealing with their own shadowed pasts. But as the nation's first public university, doesn't this institution carry the burden of establishing the tone and creating a path for others to follow? The honor of the nation's first perhaps comes with its responsibilities. Is it time, I guess we should ask, that the landscape spoke too about this shadowed past, and that the landscape marked perhaps a change in attitude? And only then, perhaps, only when that narrative written down in our everyday spaces reflects the very community that makes this and calls that a home, only then, perhaps, can we move forward. Maybe the next 16 years in Chapel Hill, just as much time as it took the grassroots movement, the Real Silent Sam Coalition, to really bring this to national attention. Maybe in the next 16 years can be a time of historical reflection, a time of looking in the past to be able to look forward. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out on the internet at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to the episode, Unwanted Heritage. Brought these three sites together to show that this is a process, and it's one that never ends. There are milestones, for sure, This is a struggle to produce a memorial landscape that truly reflects our society. The landscape should also reflect that struggle and those milestones. The work of the citizens of Budapest was perhaps clear. Let's get rid of the obvious Soviet presence, but they were left with the question, where does it go? In Braunau, the question remains in many ways what this house is a symbol of, or if it should be or has to be a symbol of anything at all. In Chapel Hill, it seems that finally there's a consensus after at least 16 years of grassroots work on the issue and decades of forgetting or avoidance, that something should be done. Who will write that something and how is left to be decided. I want to thank Doris Skulkic from Budapest, Florian Kontenko from Braunau, and the Real Silent Sam Coalition, although we haven't heard from them tonight. I did meet members of the coalition a few years ago when I myself was on the campus of Chapel Hill and was teaching a course on memorial landscapes, and we invited them in right there in Saunders Hall to discuss William Saunders. In our next episode, we'll look at the expedition as a form of writing ourselves into the landscape. Stay tuned for that one. And until then, ciao. Que les vaya bien.